I'm pleased to be back for the second night of what is supposed to be a four-night public debate regarding scientific creationism versus evolution. Now, they say that debates are learning experiences, and I have learned a lot already. I have learned that a rose is a rose by any other name, but scientific creationism is whatever you want it to be. Let me explain why I say this. Dr. Payne said last night that we were here to examine in this debate evolution versus creation, but that he will not represent any particular view, any particular model of creation. He said, therefore, that in large measure, what I had presented regarding so-called scientific creation model would not need to be responded to. What an extraordinary debate strategy. This is not a minor tactic to sidestep one or two particularly difficult arguments, but a sweeping strategy to avoid a scientific defense of the so-called and well-named, well-publicized scientific creationism and scientific creation model. Now, I'm not sure I blame him for wanting to do this. I have always felt that scientific creationism was scientifically indefensible. And perhaps Dr. Payne agrees that the specific tenets of so-called scientific creationism are scientifically indefensible also. But he didn't want to be candid with me about this because he didn't want to jeopardize the opportunity of getting me to play the role of clay pigeon on stage with him. But what he is doing is absolutely contrary to the letter and spirit of the debate agreement, in my opinion. How can we scientifically examine, in debate, scientific creationism versus evolution if I represent evolution, but Dr. Payne will not represent scientific creationism? I believe that Dr. Payne is trying to capitalize on a subtle warning, which he did give me in his letters, leading up to the presumed mutual understanding of what this debate specifically was about. Now, everyone who knows me, and there's a few here present, will tell you that I am a person of total candor. It's probably a serious fault of mine. And I expect, naively, I admit it, equal candor from others. I accepted Dr. Payne's caveat, or warning, as a small but reasonable loophole through which Dr. Payne could escape any personal liability from association with the serious errors in scholarship which Marse and Gish and the ICR habitually commit. And that was fine with me, very reasonable. I did not imagine that the small loophole would become a gaping hole through which I could be railroaded into a debate that I went to great extremes to avoid. And I want to illustrate for you the great extremes I went to avoid what is happening, by sharing excerpts of two letters Dr. Payne and I exchanged prior to this debate. You got it. I'll read these. I know that's hard to see. This is an excerpt from a letter of mine, June 3. But in those many public debate letters of mine, in those many public letters of mine, I have not criticized just any variation of creationism, but only that variation identified as a scientific creation model. And so I do not want, and have not agreed, to debate publicly or public debate just any variation of creationism, and indeed I find no fault with all creation models. In another place in that letter I wrote, repeating, be sure I was understood, I have not agreed to debate just any variation of creationism, but I have agreed to debate the Morris, Gish, ICR, CRS, and CLP variation identified by those proponents as the scientific creation model, and which is found at the heart of current and recent legislative bills for equal time. Another place in that letter, in item 1 of page 2 of your letter, a prior letter that I had received, you said you will not be restricted to the particular views of Morris Gish at all. But when you wrote this, did you mean you will not defend the model of scientific creationism found in Keystone books like Scientific Creationism and Evolution, the Fossils Say No, and the ICR Impact Series? I asked that question. And in this next paragraph, I explain what restricted to seems to mean to me, so it should have been clear if I was wrong. If not, then Allen has not found the disputant he agreed to find. If you will not defend, which does not mean be restricted to, the views regarding scientific creationism promulgated by linchpin scientific creationists like Morris, Gish, Bliss, Brown, Kofall, Slusher, Barnes, Whitcomb, whose views and what scientific model of creation will you defend? A reasonable question going into debate. And this is, in my view, the essence of the response that I got, and I thought I understood it. Dear Frank, excerpt. With regard to scientific creationism, I will certainly refer to some of the works of Gish, Morris, et al., and will espouse some of their views, but I will not be restricted to their particular model in all respects. From Buddy. Excellent, Frank. Now, Dr. Payne wrote, will not be restricted in all respects. And apparently meant, based on what I heard last night, will not be restricted in hardly any respect. Now, if Dr. Payne really meant the latter, and there was no question about what I meant, why did he not candidly state the latter? He knew, based on the very full explanation of my correspondence, of my understanding, right or wrong, of what this debate was about, of what his role in it would be, and therefore what the focus of all my preparations for this debate would be. And it must have been great fun indeed. Next one, Frank. It must have been great fun indeed for him to announce that in large measure, much of what I presented last night need not be responded to. You've seen the cartoon where the engineers are building the railroad and they're coming out of the side of the mountain or across the desert and they don't match up. My correspondence, you've just seen a small part of it, made it perfectly clear that I was preparing to debate scientific creationism, that that's the only variation of scientific creationism I wanted to debate, and that's the only variation I'm going to continue to debate. But I find that that's not what my opponent has prepared. Now, I've searched for an analogy which could help the majority of this audience understand my grievance fully. And I think I have one. Suppose I had agreed to come debate to debate a religious issue, and I said in advance that I would represent the position of the Church of Christ on that issue, but I would not be restricted to the Church of Christ view in all respects. And then when I got here, I actually presented almost exclusively the views of Herbert W. Armstrong's Worldwide Church of God, pointing out that I said I wouldn't be restricted to the views of the Church of Christ. Now, if I did that, surely my opponent would be justified in charging me with having misrepresented what I had planned to say. And I believe that Dr. Payne, knowing fully what I was prepared to do for this debate, based on my correspondence, that he misrepresented to me, possibly tacitly or by omission, what he had planned to come here and present. I may be wrong on this, and we'll have a chance to hear Dr. Payne on this. But I leave it to you folks to judge for yourself. Now, here are five essential tenets of so-called scientific creationism, with a few of the many references where these can be found. I am providing Dr. Payne with a transparency of these in the hopes that he will tell us which of these tenets he subscribes to and is willing to defend scientifically, and all these tenets are in my correspondence, and which of these he is not willing to defend scientifically in debate. Now, under the rules of the debate agreement, Dr. Payne is not obligated to respond to anything I say until Thursday night. But I hope that he will agree that my grievance merits a response, given that it is crucial to my understanding and thus my participation in this debate. Quite candidly, I resent the necessity of sidetracking so much of my regular presentation time for this clarification. But in my judgment, it was made necessary for me to do so. So now I will proceed to present as much of what I had originally planned as I can, knowing the clock will catch me in mid-sentence. And when it does, I'll zip my lip, take my lumps, take my seat, and hear what Dr. Payne has to say. We're going to begin, Frank, on the next one. You got it. Last night I explained the major elements of evolution theory. Variation, mutation, geographical isolation, and natural selection. And I gave a number of examples from nature and one from the laboratory, demonstrating the sufficiency of these to produce new species from prior species. I also presented the five essential tenets of so-called scientific creation model, which scientific creation is saying deserves equal time, equal consideration as a legitimate scientific alternative to evolution. Last night I presented clear evidence from the creationists' own literature that the leaders of the so-called scientific creationist movement have admitted, and therefore know full well, that their so-called scientific creation model is not scientific, but rather Bible-based religion. I think that's fair. I didn't want to come out and ask for that, and I appreciate that you all came to that conclusion on your own. Thank you. So, Tom, I'm relying entirely on you on this one. Okay. Well, when we get it close to about 5 minutes, try to get my attention. Appreciate that. To pick up where I was, did everyone hear that? I get my full time on my presentation, and Dr. Payne gets as much time as I just used up to respond to what I said, and I think that's very reasonable, and I appreciate that. But anyway, last night I showed from the creationist's own literature that their so-called scientific creation model, and they know this, they have admitted this, is not scientific, but Bible-based religion, and I hope most of you were here last night to see that. So they know this, they know that it is Bible-based religion and not scientific, yet they persist in calling their model scientific creation. Well, that's why I have adopted the habit of putting words so-called in front of words like creation science and scientific creationism to remind you that those terms do not refer to something which is scientific. The so-called scientific creationism or so-called scientific creationism may be excellent theology for some people, and that's fine. But as science, it is a monumental fraud. Tonight I will contrast the so-called scientific creation model with evolution in the light of scientific evidence so that you can see what a monumental fraud scientific creation is as science. Now in this debate we have two theories or models attempting to provide scientific explanation for the history of Earth's biology, the so-called scientific creation model and evolution. Scientific creationism, you recall from last night, and I have them on the screen here too, has five essential points. The first point is that the universe, the earth, and all life were created out of nothing 6 to 10,000 years ago or thereabouts. And the second point is that all the different kinds of plant and animal life appeared on earth simultaneously in sort of a side-by-side creation with no shared ancestry between the originally created kinds. The third and fourth point simply say that evolution cannot happen like scientists think, or at least if it does happen, it happens only within kinds, producing new species, but not new kinds. Dr. Payne has made it clear that he supports this tenet. The fifth point says that all fossil-containing geology of the Earth was formed in a single worldwide flood that lasted about a year and occurred after the appearance of all the kinds of life Earth forms. In other words, the so-called scientific creation model says there was no universe, Earth, or life, and then suddenly there was the universe, the Earth, and life, more or less as we see it today. Evolution, on the other hand, posits that the history of biological environments is a long and changing one. That variation, mutation, natural selection and isolation, geographical isolation, provide the means for life to genetically adapt to these changes, and that this process allows for species to derive from other species in a way that provides for a common ancestry, ultimately, of all living things. In other words, evolution entails a dynamic biosphere on a planet which is a whole lot older than just a few tens of thousands of years, and predicts that the diversity of life, both present and past, did not appear simultaneously in the Earth's history, but rather appeared in a succession over millions and millions of years. Now, as Ken Miller observed in a debate with Duane Gish, sometimes in science, two competing theories make predictions that are so very close, we have to measure things very carefully, split hairs, so to speak, in order to be able to distinguish and choose between them. But not tonight, folks, not in this debate. These two models entail such drastically different predictions and consequences that they are light years apart. And we ought to be able to look up at the sky or down through the ground and find the truth staring back at us plainly. And you know what? It does. We find the truth staring right back at us. So first, let's look up into the sky. And right away, we come up with a scientifically insurmountable problem for the first tenet of the so-called scientific creation model. This is a galaxy, where the arrow is, that was recently discovered by the Einstein Orbiting Observatory, and this galaxy is located 12 billion light years from Earth. Now, light really zips along lickety-split. It travels faster than anything else science has yet discovered. And more importantly, the velocity of light in space is absolutely constant. There has never been one shred of scientific evidence that light has ever traveled faster in the past, which doesn't rule out the possibility. But there has never been any evidence that it has. And the light from this galaxy required 12 billion years to reach the Earth. Now, if the universe were only 10 or so thousand years old, we wouldn't be able to see this galaxy yet. But we do. We see the light from this galaxy, this light which has been traveling 12 billion years. And so what's the scientific conclusion, the scientific interpretation of this data? The universe is at least 12 billion years old. The scientific evidence says the universe is at least 12 billion years old, but the so-called scientific creation model says the universe is only 10,000 years old, or thereabouts. Now that's an error of 120 million percent. Not a hair splitter by any stretch of the imagination. The so-called scientific creationists have pondered this problem and produced a number of counterarguments against this troublesome evidence, which they hope to sell you as being legitimately scientific. And here's one from Henry Morris. My apologies, but Henry Morris speaks for scientific creationism on page 62 of his remarkable book, The Remarkable Birth of Planet Earth. And he says, quote, "Had not God created light on day one prior to his construction of lights on day four? It is even possible that the light bathing the earth on the first 3 days was created in space as en route from the innumerable light bearers which were yet to be constituted on the fourth day," end quote. In other words, the Creator gave the light from extremely remote objects like the galaxy I showed you a head start. Now, this sounds very reasonable at first, and certainly the Creator had the power to do it. But some folks feel this sort of smacks of deceit on the part of the Creator, and many Christians do not consider this very good theology. As science, it is absolutely terrible. As science, it is so bad that it cannot be considered, yet it is offered. It cannot be tested in any scientific sense. There is no scientific evidence that can be called on to support this. So that even if true, this argument is scientifically null and void because it says, in effect, that evidence doesn't matter. But in science, evidence is all that matters. By the evidence, then, the age of the universe is in the teens of billions of years old. So much for looking up into the sky. Let's look down through the ground. In Wyoming, there is an extensive sedimentary formation known as the Green River Oil Shale Formation. It is rich in fossils, some of which are featured in this month's National Geographic. This formation is comprised of extremely thin, alternating, light-dark layers of sediment known as varves. Varves can be seen forming today in glacial lakes in Canada and Alaska, and they are like the annual rings in trees. The light-dark layers represent winter and summer sedimentation, And there are over 50 million such light, dark, alternating sediments in the 2-mile-thick Green River Formation. This means that the Earth cannot be younger than 50 million years, and life has been around that long too. The Earth may or may not be a whole lot older than that, but it cannot be younger than 50 million years. That's the unequivocal evidence. Or is it unequivocal? The ICR scientists claim that the 2-mile-thick Green River Formation was deposited in 1 year's time by the worldwide Genesis Flood. Henry Morris qualifies the Green River Formation, which is indeed rich in fish fossils, as a fossil graveyard. And that means that it had to be the work of a mighty flood sweeping across the land, accumulating fish and fowl from remote locations, and piling them up at the Green River location. In this 1983 booklet, which I didn't bring with me, of Morris entitled Science, Scripture, and a Young Earth, Dr. Morris cites a paper published in the scientific journal Geology, published by two scientists who have studied the Green River fossils extensively, and he quotes them as follows. Furthermore, fossil catfish are distributed in the Green River Basin over an area of 16,000 square kilometers. Even the skin and other soft parts, including the adipose fin, are well preserved, strongly suggests that the catfish could have been transported to their site of fossilization.
End of quote, unquote.
Well, this sounds convincing, especially coming from two scientists who have nothing to do with so-called creation science. But before you write off the Green River as evidence of an elusive worldwide Genesis flood, I want to tell you a couple of things that Dr. Morris didn't. The first is that for a flood of 1 year's duration to be responsible for depositing the Green River Formation, it would, from its boiling, raging chaos, have had to sort out its suspended particulates and lay them down into uniformly thin, alternating, light-dark layers at the rate of two such layered pairs every 3 seconds to account for the 50 million annual varves that comprise the 2-mile-thick formation. Now, this is like putting a scoop of chocolate ice cream and vanilla ice cream into your blender, running it for a few seconds or minutes, and then ending up with all the ice cream sorted out into 1,000 paper-thin, uniform layers of alternating dark and light vanilla and chocolate ice cream. Talk about the violations of the second law. In short, explaining the Green River Formation as a result of a violent year-long flood is simply preposterous. No, it's not simply preposterous. It is outrageously preposterous. But this is not the only or even the most outrageous thing about Morris's response to the Green River evidence. Let's examine Morris's handling as an example of creationist scholarship that's published. Let's examine Morris's handling of the scientific citation for the transporting of the catfish to their Green River graveyard and compare his quote with what was actually written in the cited paper. There we go. I wanted to talk to the slide on this, and I'm going to try to do it. The upper section is what Morris published as a quote of quote. Preservation is excellent. In some specimens, even the skin and outer parts, including the adipose fin, are well preserved. Strongly suggests that the catfish could have been transported to their site of fossilization. This is impressive, especially to the general public. But the original paper cited is below. And what is underlined in the below quote is what was actually written, is what Morris quoted, I should say, and everything there is what's written. And here's what it says. The abundant and widespread occurrence of skeletons of bottom feeders, some with soft fleshy skin intact, strongly suggests that the catfish, that's above too, were a resident population. It is highly improbable that the catfish, and now we resume, could have been transported to their site of fossilization. By selective mid-sentence omission in rendering this quote, creationist Morris diametrically reverses the meaning of the original text. Now, this is outrageous scholarship. Yet a great many scientific creationists hold Morris in unquestioned reverence as a careful scholar, scientific authority championing good science in the name of creation. And the sad thing is, this is not an isolated incident or instance. So many examples of errors like this in appalling scholarship like this have been identified in the collective works of the ICR Brain Trust that even if I did believe in the creation science model, I'd be too embarrassed to call myself a scientific creationist. Now, what I'd like to hear from Dr. Payne is this. Does he subscribe to and endorse this sort of blatant misrepresentation in scholarship as exemplified by the leadership of the so-called creation science movement? And if not, why is he not openly vocal in his opposition of that, considering the damage they are doing by in impugning the credibility of all creationists who do not buy in on their view included? And if he does not support any of the five tenets of so-called scientific creationism, why won't he come out clearly and say so? He is not reluctant to tell us where he disagrees with evolution, and we'll be listening for his answer. Another thing we find when we look through the ground are radioisotope... One more thing. Another thing we find when we look down through the ground are radioactive isotopes of chemical elements. Radioactive isotopes, or radioisotopes for short, are isotopes which decay into other isotopes. Each radioisotope has a characteristic and constant rate of decay expressed as its half-life. The half-life of each radioisotope is constant and virtually independent of any chemical or physical conditions that are imposed on it, so that radioisotopes provide a sort of nuclear clock which might provide a clue to the age of the Earth. Disregarding radioisotopes with half-lives less than 1,000 years, and also disregarding radioisotopes which are being constantly generated by cosmic ray actions and other processes, there are 40 relatively short-lived radioisotopes with half-lives between 1,000 years and 50 million years, and 17 relatively long-lived radioisotopes with half-lives of over 50 million years. Now, if the Earth was infinitely old, we wouldn't expect to find any of these isotopes, these radioisotopes, because they would have all decayed away. But the nuclear arms race testifies to the fact that we do have some radioisotopes with us. So we know that the Earth is not infinitely old. On the other hand, if the Earth had been created relatively recently, we would expect to find some of the relatively short-lived radioisotopes. So scientists have gone out and looked to see how many of these relatively short-lived radioisotopes we can find on Earth. There are 40. If any of these 40 relatively short-lived radioisotopes are found, even in just barely detectable amounts, creationists can claim them as bona fide evidence, hard scientific evidence, that the Earth is young. And how many of these do we detect on Earth? None. Zero. Zip. 0 for 40. The Earth is not young. On the other hand, we do find all 17 of the relatively long-lived radioisotopes on Earth, and the shortest-lived one of them has a half-life of 82 million years. Now, knowing that the Earth is too old for any detectable amount of a radioisotope with a half-life of 50 million years to still be found, but knowing that it is too young for all of a radioisotope with a half-life of 82 million years to have decayed away, scientists can estimate the age of the Earth. And the answer to the estimate is about 4.5 billion years. That's the age that corresponds to the break between detectable and indetectable radioisotopes, the abundances. Now, by itself, the age of the Earth estimated from radioisotope abundances is very provocative, but by no means conclusive. However, this age of 4.5 billion years for the Earth is independently confirmed using certain radioisotopes a different way to date rocks. The method is called radiometric dating, and it also depends on the constant rate of decay of the radioisotopes. Here's a slide showing some of the radioisotopes used in radiometric dating. There are others used besides these. Now, the so-called scientific creationists don't like radiometric dating, and small wonder. They say radiometric dating is unreliable and inaccurate. And in general, they seem to think that professional radiometric chronologists are a pack of fools, knaves, and rabid evolutionists unscrupulously documenting their preconceived notions. But in fact, radiometric chronologists are careful, conscientious scientists who check and recheck their assumptions constantly. Now, radio dating is not reliable with just any material. There are varieties of clams, for example, that construct their shells from ancient calcium carbonate obtained from old sediments containing very little residual carbon-14, so that their shells give inaccurately old dates with carbon-14. But radiometric scientists know about these and about other materials where their methods fail. In other words, radiometric scientists know the limits of their methods. Different radioisotopes can often be used to date the same materials, which provides a cross-check of the method. Oh, that's the wrong one. If I back that up. Well, let me take a look here. There you go. Here's a table I made showing the concordance, or agreement, obtained by radiometric dating using different radioisotopes. And each radioisotope involves different assumptions. And as you can see, I hope you can see, the concordance obtained in radiometric dating using different radioisotopes is quite good, well within the limits of measurable error. This concordance like this, where we get such close agreement over such diverse materials and ages, this concordance gives scientists excellent reason for placing high confidence in radio dating when applied to known suitable materials. In this table, we find rocks dated from 2.7 million years ago all the way up to 3.5 billion years ago. Now, currently, the oldest rocks to have been radiometrically dated from the Earth come from Western Australia, and they're measured at 4.1 billion years. Now, scientists share with the so-called scientific creationists the belief that the Earth, the Moon, and the meteoritic space debris in our solar neighborhood were all formed at the same time. Moon rocks and meteorites have been carefully dated by several different radio dating methods to be 4.3 to 4.7 billion years old. The inescapable scientific conclusion from all this? It is that the Earth is surely more than 4 billion years old and probably 4.5 billion years old. Now, the so-called scientific creation model calls for an age of the Earth of about 10,000 years. And this is at odds with the evidence to the tune of 45 million%. That's not as impressive as the 120 million% error in the age of the universe, but again, it is hardly a hair splitter. Now, how do those creationists who call themselves objective and scientific deal with this evidence, interpret this evidence, if you will? Quite remarkably, really, and most unscientifically. They say the data are simply being wrongly interpreted. Here's what scientific creationist leader Henry Morris says on page 89 of his remarkable book, The Remarkable Birth of Planet Earth. Quote, "We are forced to the conclusion, as Bible-believing Christians, that the Earth is really quite young after all, regardless of the contrary views of the evolutionary geologists. This means, then, that all uranium-lead measurements, the potassium-argon measurements, and all similar measurements, which show greater ages, have somehow been misinterpreted." End of quote. Indeed. So much for the so-called scientific creationist regard for evidence. Now, please understand that it is not the beliefs and interpretations of the so-called scientific creationists that I take exception with here tonight. I take exception only to the name they give it, the name they give their beliefs and interpretations. They call them scientific, when in painfully obvious fact, they are religious beliefs and interpretations which border on the downright anti-science. So we've seen how the evidence from science and nature shows the Earth to be about 4.5 billion years old. Now, the history of life is written in the form of the fossil record, and it is found embedded in the rock layers of the Earth's geology. And the chronology of the Earth's geology is known as the geological column. The so-called scientific creationists will tell you that the geological column, which is a chronologically sequenced construct of the Earth's geology, was originally constructed upon the assumption of evolution. That is, on the assumption of the evolution of small organisms to large, simple organisms to complex organisms. They say that fossils were used to date rocks when the geologic column was originally constructed, so that using the geological column to date fossils is circular reasoning. But this is absolutely false. It is an egregious error. For those of you who don't know what egregious means, it means a whopper. The geological column, which you see here, was originally constructed by creationists in the early 19th century, decades before anybody ever heard of Darwin's theory of evolution. The geological column was constructed using established methods for distinguishing younger layers from older layers. Fossils were not used for this. Fossils were used only to index or correlate rock layers between different geographical locations. The use of index fossils has nothing whatever to do with an assumption of evolution. It has only to do with an empirical fact that some life forms change through time, and that this change is useful in determining whether or not two remotely located rock strata were formed at the same time. Fossils were not used to date rocks, but rather merely to correlate layers of rock. So I repeat, the geological column was originally constructed by creationists decades before Darwin discovered evolution, and no assumption of evolution was involved. There is no circularity of reasoning. And this subject in and of itself would be an excellent subject for a one-night intensive debate, if anyone were interested in doing that. Now, this is the geological column here that you see, on which the history of life is written in the form of the fossil record. And you can find this in any encyclopedia or in most college dictionaries. Now, the dates that we have down the side, the geological time scale, that came along later. But all of the strata were organized and layered according to young and older and older and older by creationists at the turn of the 19th century. They didn't put dates on it. They made some estimates, but they weren't all so hot on that. But when we did finally discover how to do radiometric dating, and we went back and did radiometric dating in order to put dates on this time scale, we found it wasn't necessary to change hardly anything. That is to say that the creationists who decided that this rock strata must be older than this other one, so it goes under here, and this other rock strata, it must be younger than this other one, it must go up here, their judgment was borne out. It was confirmed by radiometric dating. Remarkable coincidence. Or maybe not coincidence, maybe good science. My creationist friend, Alan Turner, has told me several times that the fossil record is exactly what so-called scientific creation model predicts. And if he's right, we should find in the fossil record girls and snails and puppy dog tails all strewn out up and down the column clean down to the Cambrian. And if evolution is right, we should instead find fossils of all different kinds of life appearing not simultaneously, but rather appearing in a succession as we move up the geological column. So again, we have predictions from these two models which are not hair splitters. We should be able to look at the fossil record and see at a glance which of these two models explains the evidence. And so let's look to see what we find in the fossil record. Do all major groups of plants and animals appear simultaneously and relatively recently, as the so-called scientific creation model predicts? Or do they instead appear in a succession over millions and millions of years, as evolution predicts? Who will a fossil record declare the winner of this debate? Dr. Payne or me? Now, Dr. Payne has possibly arranged it so he can't lose, but I can still win. Bingo! I win! The fossil record looks like evolution. All the major groups of living organisms, just a few of which I could get on this chart, appear in a succession spanning over a billion years, just as evolution predicts. What we find is not at all what the so-called scientific creation model predicts. We find snails down here about 400, nearly 500 billion, million years ago, Puppy dog tails appear way up there about 25 or 30 million years ago, and we didn't find a girl until about 3.5 million years ago. And her name was Lucy. Now, the so-called scientific creationists do make some pretty creative attempts to theorize around this extremely damaging evidence. And here's one, which we find in a creationist textbook intended for high school biology use in a secular environment, entitled Biology, A Search for Order and Complexity. This is found on page 415, where a sort of swift and upwardly mobile hypothesis is forwarded to explain the stratified succession of fossil organisms found in the geological column. And I quote from about the middle of this, quote, "It is true that in a given area where several layers are represented, the deepest layers generally contain less complex forms than the shallower layers. This could be explained by the fact that most fossil material was laid down by the flood in Noah's time. As the flood waters rose, less complex forms, being less able to escape, would be buried first. And more mobile forms could move to higher ground," end quote. Now, there are so many holes with this so-called scientific explanation that I hardly know where to begin. In the first place, it is not a fact that a single worldwide flood laid down most fossil material, because it is not a fact of science, geology, or archaeology, that there has ever been a single worldwide flood of the proportions of the biblical Noachian deluge. And so we can't use that in a secular environment as a scientific explanation. In the second place, this upwardly mobile hypothesis suggests that fish will be found buried in the deepest layers of the geological column because they live at the depths, and amphibians would be next because they live near shorelines. And slow things like turtles and dinosaurs are buried in the middle layers because they're not particularly fast or good climbers. And humans and other highly mobile mammals made it to the hilltops and would be drowned and buried last and found only in the upper layers of the fossil record. And this sounds really good, except that right away we come up with problems. For one thing, most fish fossils are found higher in the geological column than the amphibians and the reptiles. The block on the left represents the prediction of the creation model. There is a quote from Morris there that says amphibians and reptiles would be found in still higher elevations than the fish in the commingled sediments at the interface between land and water. But the observation is on the right. What we actually find are the greatest number and diversity of fishes near the very top. Observation does not get explained by the scientific creation hypothesis. For another thing, there is an orderly succession of clams running through 500 million years of the geological column. An orderly succession, not a hodgepodge of all different kinds of clams, and none of them have been found with legs, contrary to the cartoon Spit BC. And consider this three-toed sloth. Well, we all know how slow a sloth is. Yet we encounter the giant sloths only near the top of the geological column, corresponding to about 2 million years ago, very, very up there in that little bitty thin, what would be a line if there were a line drawn there. That's where the sloth appears in the geological column. And we know that a number of dinosaurs were extremely swift runners, some able to hit 60 miles an hour, it's been estimated. Yet we do not find any in the geological column more recently than about 60 million years ago. How could the slow sloth outpace the swift dinosaurs? And marine invertebrates, which live on the seafloor, ought to have been the very first to be buried. But we do not find the majority in the very earliest layers of the geological column. We find, and the prediction of the creation model, again, is on the left. Observation and nature is on the right. And we find most of the invertebrates up in the middle layers, starting just above, in and above the Cambrian. So if all the Earth's geology were caused by a single flood, why don't we find animals at the very bottom layers, at least those that live on the ocean floor? And why don't we find flying reptiles like Pteranodon and Rhomphorhynchus in the upper layers with the birds? But we don't. At this point, the so-called scientific creationists usually reinforce this ad hoc hypothesis of upward mobility with a second hypothesis that's called hydraulic sorting. This essentially says, and I'll read what Henry Morris says at the bottom of the slide, the simpler animals, more nearly spherical or streamlined in shape, would tend to settle out first. This is a hypothesis to explain the stratification. And there's a sea urchin there. The sea urchin is spherical, slow as molasses, sinks like a rock, and lives on the ocean floor. But we don't find what is predicted by the creation model. We find that beginning in about in the middle, as you can see there, a regular succession. And by succession, I mean an ordering of species as we go up the column. A succession of species with the greatest diversity in numbers found in the very top layers. Now, evolution explains all of this. But the so-called scientific creation model doesn't even acknowledge this. And consider these three different kinds of swimmers. The shark, the amphibian ichthyosaur, and the mammal dolphin. If animals were buried sorted by their habitat or by their general shape and size, we should find these three animals together in the geologic column. But sharks are found in an orderly succession of species all through the column, beginning as far back as 360 million years ago. That's about the third line down, almost the fourth line down. Ichthyosaurs, on the other hand, are found no lower than 210 million years and no higher than 80 million years. And none of the cetacean mammals, which includes dolphins, are found lower than 50 million years ago. And what about plant fossils? Here's what the plant fossil, record looks like. It's found up here too, but I've just broken plants out. Pine trees, which are, ferns and mosses are found way back in the geological column about 400 million years ago. Pine trees, which are gymnosperms, those are awful. I can't even read them from here. Trust me, okay? Or write me and ask me about it later. Pine trees, which are gymnosperms, first make their appearance about 250 million years ago, and angiosperms, which include hardwood trees and garden flowers, aren't found in the fossil record until about 120 million years ago. Now, getting all caught up in the spirit of theoretical creationism, this must mean that oak trees can outrun pine trees, and pine trees can outpace ferns, which are sort of the snails of the plant kingdom, I suppose. Now, the fact of the matter is, nothing in the geological column and fossil record makes sense when viewed from the so-called scientific creation model, which is not a model by any other name. It only makes sense in the light of evolution. Not only is the so-called scientific creation model unable to provide an effective scientific explanation for the history of life on Earth, it doesn't even recognize the nature of the history of life as revealed by the evidence of the fossil record. It may be good enough theology for some folks, but you should now have a clear understanding of why, as science, it is a monumental fraud. Tonight I have shown the so-called scientific creation model to be in error to the tune of 120 million percent on the age of the universe, 45 million percent on the age of the earth, and that it does not even predict, let alone explain, the history of life on earth, as revealed by the fossil record. Now, I'm not going to tell you that evolution makes sense out of everything in biology. No scientist will tell you that. But certainly you can begin to see that in biology, nothing makes sense except in the light of evolution. Now, there's so much very more I want to present. Much more evidence from evolution, from biochemistry, biogeography, and the fossil record. There are other items, too. I have them up there, experimental genetics and embryology. We talked about some of that yesterday. Biochemical similarities, I think, are among the more compelling evidences of evolution. Many people say that the fossil record is the greatest source of evidence for evolution, but that is not correct. It was the first, and it remains an impressive source. Time is limited, though, and I can't possibly cover everything tonight, and I had to choose what I thought was most relevant to the contrast between so-called scientific creationism and evolution. Before I say any more, can you give me a report of my time? I have 7 whole minutes. Well, you were gracious enough to give me back some time I used up, so I don't think I will take advantage of your generosity. I'll be looking for opportunities to present these and other evidences for evolution Thursday and Friday night. I thank you for attention, and now let's listen carefully to what Dr. Payne has to say.
It's time for us to resume. I do want to explain one thing about the time problem. We determined, after Mr. Lovell had introduced this matter of arrangements, that he still needed his 45 minutes for his presentation. We wanted him to have that. So 10 minutes have been added. So what we're doing, we'll have 10 minutes for Dr. Payne to rebut Mr. Lovell's first 10 minutes. We'll call time, change the tape, then he'll have 45 minutes for his presentation in the debate itself. So I present now Dr. Payne.
Okay, let me just say a few words. As has been explained, it's my understanding I'm to have just a few minutes in order to respond to what Mr. Lovell had to say at the beginning. And I would like to say, of course, that it's unfortunate that clearly he had a misconception of what I meant. And so I would like to take the opportunity to explain to you, as he has, with excerpts from our correspondence. I had some notion last night that this would be the case tonight, since Frank appeared rather upset. So I thought I should be prepared to at least answer as I understood it. And surely everybody in this audience knows that people can misunderstand each other. I think that's what's happened. I think when I get finished explaining tonight, Mr. Lovell will be much more at ease that there's still plenty to debate about. I don't think that will be a problem when we get finished. So let's flash on the screen some of the correspondence. He referred to one letter in his presentation, as I recall, and I would like to give you just a little background. This debate was arranged through Mr. Turner and the people in Louisville. I live in Florida. So Mr. Lovell and I had no direct correspondence until I received a packet of material from him in the month of May. When I read that packet of material, I became rather disturbed because I thought I understood the proposition. He says he thought he understood it. I thought I understood it. But when I received his material and read it, I didn't think I understood it. So I immediately wrote him a letter. And included in the letter were some points. I said, first, I'm not sure from reading your letter and correspondence what you mean by evolution. You see, evolution itself is a very nebulous term, as I mentioned to you last night. Obviously, that word is ambiguous, even in its uses in science, and should be carefully understood by both of us if we are to conduct a debate involving it. When I read the proposition, I understand evolution to mean the theory that all living things share a common ancestry, not just species are related to species by descent, and that the first living things arose from non-living matter spontaneously without a creator. It appears that you are restricting your definition of evolution to considerably less than this. That's what I thought he was saying, and I wanted that clarified. There need not be a debate if we mean the theory that over the course of time, changes have occurred which have given rise to new species. A scientific creationist can and should incorporate this smaller theory into his explanation of the history of life on Earth. If you are not willing to affirm something closely akin to the definition above, I see no purpose in the debate. Does the history of life on Earth include the origin of life on Earth? That was another question I had in my mind. I felt like if as a creationist I had to say where life came from, he should also have to say where life came from. And it could be that the phrase, the history of life on Earth, meant only what happened after first life. And I was not satisfied with that. And he understood that. In his response, he clearly told me he would defend the general theory of evolution. Atoms to man. He said he would also defend the theory of abiogenesis, the spontaneous arising of life forms from non-living without a creator. I believe I dealt with that issue last night. He needs to deal with it also. Let's go to the next one. With regard to scientific creationism, this is from my letter of June the 6th, a second letter after the one of May 29th. With regard to scientific creationism, I will certainly refer to some of the works of Gish, Morris, et al., and will espouse some of their views. But I will not be restricted to their particular model in all respects. I will not espouse theistic evolution. I figured he might think that's where I'd go. I'm not going there. The theory that genera or families of organisms were created functionally complete with the capacity for variation within genetic limits, that's the theory, becomes scientific, and that's what I understand by scientific creationism. Why scientific? It becomes scientific when we use the methods and evidence of science to investigate its reasonableness. Now, did I define what I mean by creationism? There is another, I think. Did I specifically disavow the particular model of Gish and Morris? I don't care what he said in his letter. I disavowed their particular model, and he knew it. He may not have understood it. Pardon me, Frank. That's putting something in your head. You may not have understood that, but I think I disavowed it. Back in the May 29th letter, when I read scientific creationism in the proposition, I understand it to mean any legitimate investigation by science into the theory, and Frank corrected me on this, and he was right. Legitimate investigation is not a theory, and I was wrong in saying it that way. But the theory that genera or families of organisms were created functionally complete with the capacity for variation within limits, that's what I mean. And if you investigate it scientifically, it becomes scientific creation, as opposed to biblical creation, or any other kind of creation. This does not tie scientific creationism to the particular views of Morris and Gish, any more than evolution is tied to the particular views of Darwin or Gould. And I might add that last night, Mr. Lovell presented basically, neo-Darwinism. He did not present the position of Stephen Jay Gould. And I will not expect him to hold that particular sub-view. I expect him to defend evolution in general. And I will defend creation in general. Now, is there another? At the bottom, I said it again at the end of the letter. I will not be restricted to the particular views of Morris Gish et al. In my discussion of the scientific creationism, because that is certainly not implied in the term in my mind. Now, I had the feeling that Mr. Lovell was practically accusing me of being dishonest. I hope that was not the case. I have not been dishonest in any measure. He said I was less than candid. I'm not exactly sure how far that goes to saying somebody's been dishonest. I think that is not a proper representation of the correspondence. Let's have the next one. What did Frank know and when did he know it? Last night, Mr. Lovell made the statement in his discussion, "My opponent has already put me on notice that he will not be restricted to the particular model and the particular views of Morris, Gish, the ICR, though he will refer to some of their works and espouse some of their views." Now, did he know it last night? He said he did. And I told him. And now he gets up here and tells you that I'm not defending what I said I'd defend. That is a misrepresentation of the correspondence, my friend. And is there one more? Let's go to that one just a minute. Let me just make this observation, and really it is not material. Darwinism is a term used to describe Darwinian evolution. In this discussion from Ideology and Worldview by John Green, he takes the position that people use these ism terms rather loosely. And to say that because you call it an ism, it's bound to one specific person or groups of persons' treatment of it, I think is not proper. Even if that were not so, I explained my view. Now let's go to the model, please. Here is the model I propose and will defend, and you will see, if you would like to compare it with what he flashed on the screen and has several times, you will see it agrees in many respects with the position Morris and Gish take. Not in every respect, but in some, as I have said. First life created abruptly in complex form. That's precisely what they say. Suddenly. Major groups of organism were created abruptly. I said that last night. With the ability to change within genetic limits, the special theory. A universal flood must be considered in the interpretation of geologic evidence. All right. Okay, we're discussing the model that I am defending, in which in many respects, in some respects, matches the one Morris and Gish defend. In other respects, it does not, as I affirmed ahead of time that I would do. A universal flood must be considered in interpreting the geologic evidence. I will affirm that I believe there is evidence for a universal flood, as Morris and Gish did. The age of the earth at this time is an open question. I personally happen to be an agnostic on the age of the earth. I will show you that there are reasons to believe it is not 4.5 billion years old. I will show you there are reasons to believe it may be young. I personally am not convinced on that position at this point. There is the model I will defend. Last night, I defended it on point number one. I showed you beyond question that the evidence that is present for us today, the facts, are most reasonably explained by saying that the first life was created, not that it evolved. And I went through rather lengthy discussion to show you the evidence, and then I showed you the interpretation that a creationist would put on that evidence. The job Mr. Lovell has now is to respond to that with regard to point number one. I think there's still much to debate. Point number two deals with the origin of organisms of various groups. Now let me just say here, the word group is not scientific, I understand that. Neither is the word kind. I have said in my correspondence, I would even go so far to say as genera and family, which are scientifically defined terms, but I might add to you that classificationists, taxonomists, disagree on what constitutes a species and a genera, and there are disagreements on how those fit. So to say to me, I have got to, as a creationist, tie into a specific level of the taxonomy is simply not fair. So I will say major groups were created abruptly with the ability to change within limits. That is quite different, if I might remind Mr. Lovell, from saying they evolved. That is very different. And we have plenty to debate about still. Now I would like to turn to the topic I have chosen to discuss tonight. So if we may have the first transparency. You see, the issue we're discussing tonight is not changes of genetic frequency in a gene pool, as Mr. Lovell presented last night as what evolution is. We're not discussing that. That's not what we're debating. The issue is limited versus unlimited change. What needs to be demonstrated by the evolutionist is not that frequencies in a gene pool can change, but that you can change those frequencies sufficiently to change a population of lizards over a long period of time into a population of birds over whatever means you want to use. We're talking about limited versus unlimited. We all agree, I agree with Frank Lovell, that there are genetic frequency changes in a gene pool. I would call that the special theory of evolution. And I might say, Mr. Lovell did a wonderful job last night of describing that very thing. A little hard to deny it, or I wouldn't even want to. But that's a far cry from the unlimited change that's needed to derive a common ancestry from all living things. All right, let's go to the next one a little more quickly. The issue is not scientific data. The issue is interpretation of the data. And the next, as we tried to stress last night, the issue is not scientific fact versus religious faith. The issue is which position of faith is more reasonable based on interpretation of the data. Any position on origins is ultimately a position of faith. You weren't there. You can't observe it. It's ultimately a position of faith. The question is, which one is more reasonable? All right? And he asked last night, if we agreed on being allies against nonsense and pseudoscience, and I would have to say, Mr. Lovell, I am your ally against nonsense and pseudoscience. And if a man takes a quotation and misuses it, takes part of it and makes it mean something entirely different, he has lied and misrepresented, and that is wrong. I would have no part of that, and that's why I was a little upset at being accused of something similar myself. I would have no part in it. I have very strong feelings about that, and I know you do too. Next. We're allies in opposing pseudoscience. Here's a quote I'd like to read to you. It is time for students of the evolutionary process, especially those who've been misquoted and used by the creationists to state clearly that evolution is a fact. It's time for us to state that evolution is a fact, not theory. He's talking about the general theory, folks. Birds arose from non-birds. Humans from non-humans. No person who pretends to any understanding of the natural world can deny these facts any more than he or she can deny that the earth is round, rotates on its axis, and revolves around the sun. I am here to tell you that is pseudo-science. And it is Richard Lewontin who said it, who I believe is at Harvard University. It says at the bottom, Alexander Agassiz Professorship at Harvard University, and he ought to be ashamed. I am opposed to that kind of pseudo-science. Go to the next one. I turn now to the fossil record. Mr. Lovell also has referred to it, and he said there was nothing in it that would support the creation view. I will say to you flatly right now, there are some problems for a creationist with the fossil record. I also say there are some serious problems for the evolutionist position of the general theory. I don't claim to have all the answers. And I think that's in the greatest tradition of science. I don't think Mr. Lovell would claim to have all the answers. I think I have some, though. And I'd like to take a little different approach with you tonight. Let me quote from G.A. Kirkut again in his book, The Implications of Evolution. The most important evidence for the theory of evolution is that obtained from the study of paleontology, that's the fossils. Though the study of other branches of zoology, such as comparative anatomy or embryology, which you saw in his list that he's going to deal with later, might lead one to suspect that all animals are interrelated, it was the discovery of various fossils and their correct placing in the relative strata and age that provided the main factual basis for the modern view of evolution. Now, I know that's G.A. Kirkut's opinion. He says the fossil record is the most important. And I would like to say to you, if you were going to investigate the history of life on Earth, would not the only direct evidence you have be the record in the rocks as you go down? Where else could you investigate it directly? And even that's not direct, but that's the nearest thing you've got to it. However, there are others who say fossils do not provide the best supportive evidence for evolution. The fields of biochemical genetics, which he mentioned is a strong one, he thinks. Comparative anatomy, comparative biochemistry, and biology and biogeography provide much stronger evidence. That's Stan Weinberg's opinion. Let's go to the next one. The history of life ceases to be a hypothesis and inference and becomes direct knowledge when fossils are available, according to Simpson and Beck. They say that the fossils make it a fact. I say that is hogwash. Let's look at the fossil record. What is the actual evidence? I have tried in this debate to say we must distinguish between data and interpretation of the data. We must look at evidence independent of our presuppositions. Now, what is the actual evidence? Here it is stated, as best I could find it. And I might say to you, it is difficult to find statements of raw data. Some rocks have fossils in them. That's about the best you can do. Although most fossils are found in marine sedimentary rocks, they are also found in terrestrial deposits left by lakes and streams. Did you know that almost all the fossils have been deposited through water? Now, I'm saying that's the evidence. Let's go to the next one. Here is what the evolutionist geologist and some others, I suppose, do with it. They come up with a geologic column. And I'm not discussing that in detail tonight because I'm limiting myself to the fossils tonight. But the geologic column is a human construct that does not exist anywhere on Earth altogether. It has to be put together. It does not exist in any one place on Earth. It exists in books and in charts like this. It is an interpretation of the data. It is not data. It is an interpretation of the data. And I might say, in the geologist's viewpoint, a very well-supported one. But it is still an interpretation. It is not data. It's an interpretation. And we need to remember that. Now, from this point on, I am going to grant that geologic column. I do not grant it, and I'll argue against it later, but I'm going to grant it. Let's put it in the best light possible for the evolutionist, the general theorist. Let's grant them the column. Let's say there is such a column from less complex to more complex like that. I might say that if they represented it accurately, there'd be a lot more dotted lines, as I mentioned last night, which show they don't really know. But let's go on. Here are some quotations, and from this point on, my quotations are from evolutionists. Every single one of them. They all believe in the general theory. Do you understand that? Niles Eldridge. It is indeed a very curious state of affairs, I think, that paleontologists have been insisting that their record is consistent with slow, steady, gradual evolution, where I think that privately they've known for over 100 years such is not the case. If I understand Mr. Lovell's view, he believes in slow, gradual evolution. The neo-Darwin. You don't believe that. Okay. Well, Niles Eldridge says that that is not shown in the rocks. He says, I view stasis and the trumpeting of stasis to the whole world that the fossil record shows slow, steady, continuous change as opposed to herky-jerky patterns, as something akin to the emperor's new clothes. Paleontologists have known this for 100 years. It's the only reason they can correlate rocks with their fossils, for instance. Paleontologists, instead of saying, well, Darwin was at least not correct as far as this particular formation was concerned, they've tended to do other things. They've ignored the question completely, at least until recent times. Go to the next one. Despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for the evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. David Kitts, an evolutionist. Scoot that up if you would. Practically all orders or families known appear suddenly without any apparent transition. R.B. Goldschmidt, that's a dated quote, but there are many others just like it from modern times. Okay? Now, if the evolutionary view is true, there must be something like this, a tree of life of some kind, in which we can trace ancestry backwards to a common ancestor. And I don't pretend that this tree represents accurately the modern view exactly, but it is an illustration. And as we look at this, I would like to read you quotations from some very well-respected and significant evolutionists who believe in the general theory with regard to the fossil record. First, The earliest and most primitive members of every order already have the basic ordinal characters, and in no case is an approximately continuous series from one order to another known. In most cases, the break is so sharp and the gap so large that the origin of the order is speculative and much disputed. Now, we're talking about orders. That's one of the levels of taxonomy. And he goes on to explain a little further. That's from a book by E. Russell, Diversity of Animals, 1962, and I'll be glad to share the quote with anyone. Next one, from L. Margulis, in his book Origin, or in his article, I believe, Origin of Eukaryotic Cells. He states this in full. Morphologically and physiologically, trends from asexual blue-green algae, that's the prokaryotes, to sexual eukaryotic algae cannot be found. The more they've been sought, the more firmly has the discontinuity between the two forms been established. In other words, most people take the view in the general theory that the simplest single-cell organisms evolve into the next most complex, that is, the prokaryotes into the eukaryotes. This author says, we have been able to find no evidence whatsoever of that transition. That is, the more we know about it, the stronger the discontinuity exists. There is a gap. The first problem does not arise with respect to animals, since the gap between protista and the animal kingdom, which according to the present treatment is synonymous with metazoa, is so great that the origin of the metazoa is still obscure. Let's go to the next. And so we start now to look at the tree more like it really is from their own view. From the simple one-celled organisms to the metazoa, the more multicellular organisms, there is no evidence whatsoever of a transition. They appear suddenly with no transition. Much evidence can be adduced. Listen closely. This is a quote. Much evidence can be adduced in favor of the theory of evolution. He's talking about the general theory. You see what this man believes. From biology, biogeography, and paleontology. But I still think that to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of special creation. Can you imagine an orchid, a duckweed, and a palm have come from the same ancestry? And have we any evidence for this assumption? The evolutionist must be prepared with an answer, but I think that most would break down before an inquisition. That is from E.J.H. Corner in his article Evolution from Contemporary Botanical Thought, 1961. He says that the fossil evidence for plants is in the favor of the special creationist. So that's the next one. And so you see, the tree is missing for plants on their own admission. There are no trunks there in the fossil record. They don't exist. The evolutionary origin of the arthropods is hidden in the remote Precambrian times, according to R.E. Snodgrass in his article Crustacean Metamorphosis from the Smithsonian Miscellaneous Collection. Arthropods, like the insects, we don't know where they came from. So, that part of the tree is missing. And I didn't specify all. I could have given you a quote for every single one of those. I don't want to take the time to do it. How the earliest chordate stock evolved and what stages of development it went through eventually give rise to the truly fish-like creatures, we don't know. F. Omnami from The Fishes, 1964. How did we get fish and the first early chordates? We do not know. That is a blank. To me, one of the most astonishing consequences of the furor over cladistics, which we'll have more to say about later, is the realization that the current account of tetrapod evolution, that's four-legged creatures, shown in thousands of diagrams and everywhere acknowledged as the centerpiece of historical biology, is a will of the wisp. For nowhere can one find a clear statement of how and why the recent groups are interrelated, and the textbook stories are replete with phantoms. Extinct, uncharacterizable groups giving rise to one another, Patterson, in his book review in Systematic Zoology, we don't know where the amphibians and the reptiles came from either. The origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved. From Swinton, Biology and Comparative Physiology of Birds, we don't know where the birds came from. From the fossil record. While the fossil record of insectivore evolution is reasonably good in some lines, the transition from insectivore to primate is not documented by the fossils. The basis of knowledge about the transition is by inference from living forms. You know how they get it? They look at living forms and infer backwards. They don't get it from the fossils. This is from Kelso, Physical Anthropology, an introduction. So the rest of it for mammals is missing. I could give you a quote for every one of those places where they say the fossil record is missing. Which leads me, and hold on to that one and put it back, please, but put this on next, to this quote from Stephen Jay Gould, Evolution's Erratic Pace. The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, and not the evidence of the fossils. We need to separate between data and inference. Put that other one back on again, the last one. What he says is just what I have pictured there. The evidence is the tips and the nodes, and that is it. All right, let's go to the next one. This is a letter from a evolutionist by the name of Colin Patterson, addressed to Luther Sunderland, a creationist. Luther had read his book called Evolution, written in 1978. I have also read that book. It is an excellent little book. In his letter to him, Luther Sunderland questioned him about a few things, and I'd like to just read this letter. Thank you for your letter of March 5th, or 5 March, and your kind words about the museum and my book. See, he works for the British Museum of Natural History. I held off answering you for a couple of weeks in case the artwork you mentioned in your letter should turn up, but it hasn't. I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. You suggest that an artist should be asked to visualize such transformation. But where would he get the information from? I could not honestly provide it, and if I were to leave it to an artistic license, would that not mislead the reader? He says, why don't you get people to draw pictures of the transitions? And he says it would mislead the public. I wrote the textbook 4 years ago. If I were to write it now, I think the book would be rather different. Gradualism is a concept I believe in. He's a neo-Darwinianist. Not just because of Darwin's authority, but because of my understanding of genetics seems to demand it. Yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. I just read that to you. And that's what the record shows. As a paleontologist myself, I am much occupied with the philosophical problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. That's his work. That's what he spent his life doing. You say that I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type of organism was derived. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one can make a watertight argument. The reason is that statements about ancestry and descent are not applicable to the fossil record. You can't take one fossil and another and say, this is the ancestor of that one. He says you can't do that. Is Archaeopteryx the ancestor of all birds? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. There is no way of answering the question. It is easy enough to make up stories of how one form gave rise to another and to find reasons why stages should be favored by natural selection, but such stories are not a part of science. I'm opposed to pseudoscience. And people making up stories about how these relate when there is no evidence is not science. For there is no way of putting them to the test. And I think that's enough. Turn it off for just a minute. Darwin recognized both these problems. He knew the fossil record showed sudden appearance and no transition. And what he said was, we just got to wait because the fossil record's incomplete. My friends, we've been waiting for 120 years, and it's worse today than it was in Darwin's day. You can't make that argument anymore. How much time do you have? All right, good. I turn now to a subheading of this. We're talking about the fossil record. Let's talk about a specific case. Let's talk about humans. Most of us are interested in humans. And let's read a quote. This quote is from Science and Creationism, notice at the bottom, publication of a view from the National Academy of Sciences, a rather prestigious group. This was sent around to many people who are opposing creationism. I want to read it to you. It's on human evolution. Studies in evolutionary biology have led to the conclusion that mankind arose from ancestral primates. This association was hotly debated amongst the scientists in Darwin's day, before molecular biology and the diversity of new abundant connecting links. Today, however, there is no significant scientific doubt about the close evolutionary relationships among all primates or between apes and humans. The missing links that trouble Darwin and his followers are no longer missing. Today, not one, but many such connecting links, intermediate between various branches of the primate family tree, have been found as fossils. These linking fossils are intermediate in form and occur in geological deposits of intermediate age. They thus document the time and the rate at which primate and human evolution occurred. Now, that's a rather official statement. And I would like to suggest to you that it is blatantly false. And I'd like to show you why. Thank you. Let's go to the next one. Here is a popular representation. You might want to lower that a little bit. Of the very statement we just read from Science and Creationism. This is a popularization of what they said. And I want to read the top to you if I can read it. Here on this page, you can see step by step man's 25 million year history. You can follow our ancestors as they progress from the gibbon-like creatures. You see them up at the top, Pliopithecus, to modern man down at the bottom. You may cut out this page and use it for school or for reference. Time Life magazine put that out some years ago, and I'll say right now that I recognize that's outdated, and modern-day evolutionists do not accept that exact picture. I recognize that. That's what the public got. And among the creatures listed, and I'll not have time to talk about all of them, is a fellow over in the top right-hand corner called Ramapithecus, discovered by a gentleman named David Pilbeam. Ramapithecus was proposed to be in the direct lineage with man at one time. He was proposed to be one of our ancestors. I don't have the time to deal with all of these, so I'm going to highlight one. All right, let's see what the next one is. Kind of scoot it up so we can get the bottom one. You see, I hope you can see down here at the very bottom is Ramapithecus. This chart is a chart of all the various ones that have been proposed to be in our ancestry that have been found in the fossil record. Ramapithecus is one found in 1964, David Pilbeam and Elwin Simons. They are still very active today. They proposed Ramapithecus as one of the ancestors of man. In 1979, they changed their mind and decided that he wasn't in our ancestry, but he was in the ancestry of the orangutan and really not related in our direct line. Let's show one picture of what was originally proposed. Originally, Ramapithecus was proposed as being in our lineage, you see, and the branching off came at Australopithecus afarensis and over here at Homo habilis. The splitting off came after Ramapithecus, and he was a common ancestor to all. That's found in textbooks as a proposed scheme. Remember the statement I read to you at the beginning about from Science and Creationism about how all these intermediates are so well established now? Put the other chart back on that you just had. No, the one about the list of the different ones. Right. These are all different ones that have been proposed as intermediates, and all of them have been discarded as intermediates. Now the fact is, folks, the lineage of humans relative to other primates, as we are classified, is not well established at all. There's more fuss about that today than there's ever been. And to make a statement like that, to send out to the public to oppose creationists, is blatant and very poor science. All right, let's go to the next one. Now here's Ramapithecus. And let's see what evidence we build upon. What is the data and what's the interpretation for Ramapithecus? How did we decide he was in the lineage of man? On what hard evidence did we build this? Well, everybody knows that hair and skin is not preserved in the fossil record. Nobody knows about hair and skin from the fossil record. So we take off the hair and the skin, because that's inference. And when people build these models, that is totally out of their head. No evidence for the hair and the skin. There is no evidence in the fossil record for muscles, organs, nervous system. You can make some inferences, but there's no evidence directly for the muscles and the organs and the nervous system. So we take that off. Which, of course, as everybody knows, leaves the bony part, the skeleton, which is preserved over long periods of time. And you can find parts of skeletons in various places. That would be nice. If we had the skeleton, let's see what is the hard data which we actually have found for Ramapithecus. That's it. There are a few fragments of bones and about 30 teeth. And the 30 teeth came from different places. Now that's the evidence. And put back up the picture of all the people, if you will. The lineage, this one right here, this one. There he stands in Time Life publication for the public in the upper right-hand corner, and it's clearly stated you can trace our lineage right down through for 25 million years, and if that's not pseudoscience, I don't know what is. And they do not say you got one little jawbone, parts of it, and a few teeth. No, the public is led to believe that's just all so clear and plain, and that is pseudoscience. Now let's see what's next. Here is a chart that tells you the actual hard evidence that is available on all those fellows we had up there. And I know you can't read it from the back. I'll be glad for you to have a copy of it, and I want to make this appending right here. This chart was constructed in 1972. Some things have happened since then. I do not have the time, but I have the documentation of what fossils have been found since that chart was made. And I want to tell you the picture doesn't change a whole lot. Let me just highlight a few. You see old Ramapithecus there? You got two fragments of the jaw and three teeth. That's not true anymore. There's about 30 teeth. And there's part of a palate. That's a big help. For Dryopithecus, you got four teeth, one femur, two arm and hand bones, and one leg and foot bone. That's it. From Neanderthal man at the bottom all the way up, you do not have one single total skeleton of any of these fossils anywhere. Not one single total skeleton. Lucy, that Mr. Lovell mentioned, is the best they've got, and she's far from complete. And she's now been classified, best I understand, with the Australopithecines, who are in a separate line from our lineage, and they really don't know that. When you get to Neanderthal, there's all kinds of complete fossils, lots of good evidence. Everybody now says Neanderthal man is clearly modern man. That's the evidence. Let's go to the next one. Now if we may return to David Pilbeam, Harvard University, the original discoverer of Ramapithecus. He has since said Ramapithecus is not in the lineage of man, but in fact is in the lineage of the orangutan. There's a lot of question about that. Just a guess. But he says, in his review of Richard Leakey's book about origin, perhaps generations of students of human evolution, including myself, have been flailing around about in the dark, that our database is too sparse, and may I pause to say a hearty amen, too slippery for it to be able to mold our theories. But what do? They mold them right on and tell them to the public as if it were fact. Rather, the theories are more statements about us and ideology than about the past. Paleoanthropology reveals more about how humans view themselves than it does about how humans came about. You remember what I said at the very first last night? We've got to distinguish between the data and the interpretation, and that oftentimes there are presuppositions underlying how you interpret that data. Here is an outright admission by Mr. Pilbeam that that is clearly what happens in the case of humans. It's too close to our hearts. Things get mixed in there. The hard and cold facts are, and what would the creationists do with the evidence I've presented to you on the fossil record? Our interpretation is that there is not sufficient evidence to make any kind of conclusive statements about the lineage of humans and other primates. We would say the bony parts, which themselves are very few, do not define man or beast. Further study has allowed some better classification, like Neanderthal man, for example. He was originally classified as clearly the intermediate, a missing link. With further study and further collection and finds, they've found out that there are artifacts around where the fossils are found, and they've shown that he clearly had human characteristics. But how did they do that? Not from the bones, from the other artifacts like fires and paintings and things that they found. There's insufficient evidence to make determinations, and therefore the question is moot. From the fossil record, we don't know the lineage of humans, we don't know the lineage of birds, we don't know the lineage of reptiles and amphibians and fish and invertebrates and plants and arthropods and anything else. It's a big gap. Now, may I go back? Let me go to the last one. I say again, we're allies against nonsense and pseudoscience. And I put back up the original quote that we started with by Richard Lewontin, which he made in a publication and is a leader in the research, Genetic Basis of Human Evolution. And while you're looking at that quote again, I want to read you from an article that I quoted from last night called Agnostic Evolutionist, written by a man named Tom Bethel. He went around and interviewed some of these fellows that had been making some of these statements. He's interested in the creation-evolution controversy. And he asked Mr. Lewontin personally, what about that statement? Finally, it was time to get around to the point of my visit, Tom Bethel says. What about these claims? Evolution is fact. Birds evolve from non-birds. Humans from non-humans. The Cladists disapprove, I said. He paused for a split second and said, those are very weak statements. I agree. That's what Mr. Lewontin said. Now, do you think the public heard that? No, the public heard that. Anybody that has any understanding of the natural world can deny these facts more than you can deny that the earth is round. That's what he said. And now he says, they are very weak statements. I, too, am opposed to pseudoscience. Later, when the question was asked specifically about human evolution, the following was said. Quote, I'm quoting Richard Lewontin. The only way you can know that some fossil is the direct ancestor is that it's so human that it is human. Are you with me? The only way you can know a fossil is an ancestor of a human is that it's so human that it is human. There's a contradiction there. Back to the quote. If it is different enough from humans to be interesting, then you don't know whether it's an ancestor or not. And if it's similar enough to be human, then it's not interesting. He returned to his chair, looked out at the slanting rain, and said, "So, look, we're not ever going to know what the direct ancestor is." So says Richard Lewontin. And if you turn that off a moment, I want to close with just two or three other statements. I would like to say again to Frank that I apologize for any misunderstanding that there may have been. I do think, though, that there's still many things we have to debate about. And if that's not the case, and if you may get my model, please, if that's not the case, maybe we could simply agree on the model I've proposed and the debate would be over. Would you be willing for that model to be taught in public schools? From a scientific perspective, like I've been presenting tonight? I haven't mentioned the Bible once. No reference to religion. Would it be acceptable to present that model in public schools? And if so, the debate's over. Because that's what I came to debate. And if it's not, then let's continue the debate and argue the points. And I thank you very much for your attention.